From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, way later on tonight, an hour of open lines for you. Here's what's happening. The Islamic State group has now trained apparently at least 400 fighters to let them loose, targeting Europe in deadly waves of attacks, deploying interlocking terror cells like the ones that struck Brussels and Paris, with orders to choose the time, the place, and the method for maximum carnage. The network of cells shows the reach of the extremist group in Europe, even as it loses some ground in Syria and Iraq. The officials, including European and Iraqi intelligence officials and a French lawmaker who follows the jihadi networks, described the camps in Syria, Iraq, and possibly the former Soviet bloc, where the attackers are trained to attack the West. We should simply hit those camps and hit them all big. Israel's Cellebrite, which is a provider of mobile forensic software, is apparently helping the Federal Bureau of Investigation's attempt to unlock an iPhone used by one of the San Bernardino, California shooters. If Cellebrite succeeds, then the FBI will no longer need the help of Apple. Let's check in with our expert, Lauren Weinstein, to get his reaction to this story. Well, they may have found a company that could pull this off, Lauren, huh?
Well, actually, the people that are tracking this pretty closely aren't even sure that firm has anything to do with this at all.
Really?
They're actually pretty good at self-promotion, it turns out.
Oh, my God.
The history of that. And so it may be them. It may be anyone of a number of different organizations. It may be multiple organizations. It may be NSA. There's a lot of misdirection in all of this. And, of course, there's no guarantee they're actually going to succeed. There's all kinds of speculation over the technique that they might use. And you know, the way most of us are looking at it who follow, you know, the kind of crypto saga here is that this is a short-term situation. I mean, either they'll get into that phone or they won't. Either there'll be something interesting in it or there won't be. Most of these, you know, lone wolf kind of terrorists that we're talking about here aren't very sophisticated. They're not doing things that require a lot of coordination. When they do coordinate, they appear to be using burner phones by the bushel,
yeah,
rather than sophisticated communications technologies per se, and they hardly even bother with encryption. So it's just not clear what's going to happen, except we do know that the next time around, as our encryption systems get more powerful, which they have to get, as we've discussed, to protect innocent people like you and me, it's just not going to be possible to use whatever techniques they're talking about now, whether it's flash mirroring or one of the other kind of techniques that are going to be talked about. And we're going to end up back in the same place where we've been talking about for weeks now, which is that terrorists, if they want to get strong encryption without back doors, are going to find ways to get it. And if all of us end up with weak encryption, we're going to be vulnerable to criminals and terrorists. And so it's all kind of coming around again and again. And we'll see how this particular chapter ends up. But right now, it's there's a lot of misinformation, and it'll probably be a couple of weeks. The FBI actually asked for, I believe, a two-week continuance in this case.
That trial.
So within a couple of weeks, we should find out what the next chapter is.
And our friend John McAfee, of course, who invented the McAfee antivirus, says that he may know how to do this, but he said he's not the one that's involved.
Yeah, well, he says a lot of things.
he's a good promoter, too.
John has already admitted once having lied in this particular sequence of events here. So he's a lot of fun to listen to, and his Wikipedia picture is a lot of fun too, by the way, if you've never seen it.
Oh, yeah, we've seen it. Okay, thanks, Lauren.
Thanks.
Keep in touch. A kitchen worker died after she was apparently trapped inside of a walk-in freezer for about 13 hours at a downtown Atlanta hotel. A search for the woman began when she just did not return home after her shift at the Westin Peachtree Plaza, one of the city's most recognizable skyscrapers. Investigators reviewed hotel surveillance video, and they believe she may have entered the freezer at about 8 p.m. Monday, and she was found later Tuesday morning. Wow, I always thought that they had handles on the inside to prevent that. I guess not. New U.S. single-family home sales rebounding modestly in February as a surge in the West offset sharp declines in other regions, pointing to a gradual improvement, they say, in the housing sector, amid a dearth of properties available on the market. Let's check in with the other expert, Catherine Austin Fitz, publisher of the Solari Report. Catherine, so the West is doing well, but the rest of the country isn't.
Right. This is really a the West doing well story. And if, George, if you look at the foreign purchases, they've been supposedly tapering off, but they're still heavy. To give you an example, a third of the home sales in Vancouver last year, that's about a $38 billion market, were Chinese. So you have both the Asians buying and you have the Mexicans buying. So I'm not sure it signals well for the U.S. economy. That's number one. The other thing is, you know, given everything the administration is doing to encourage easy credit and home sales and the low interest rates, I expected it to be stronger. What I'm seeing in my world is more and more people buying real estate just to shift money out of the fixed income markets because yields are so low. So I was expecting to see it a little higher, and let's see what we see in spring.
All right, you got it. Catherine, thanks so much. Catherine Austin Fitz. A five-year-old South Texas girl has been credited with saving her mother. This is an amazing story. The woman had a seizure while in the family swimming pool. The rescue, captured on home surveillance video, shows Tracy Anderwald unconscious in the pool at a home near Corpus Christi. Her daughter, 5 years old, Allison, is seen wading in, dragging her mother to the shallow end, and then she manages to turn her mother over so the woman can breathe. The girl then runs to get help from other relatives who call 911. Just an amazing story. I wonder what those two, the daughter and the mother, will be talking about 20, 30 years from now. Despite hours of police coaxing, a man refused to leave his perch near the top of an 80-foot-tall sequoia tree in downtown Seattle. He was living up there in some kind of tree or a house up there. He finally came down, but wow, what a story that was. And imagine this. You're walking in a park with somebody you care about, or a friend, a child. You turn around, and that person is gone. They've gone missing. You have no idea where they are. They made no sound. They simply vanished. Up next, David Politis joins us again, Missing 411 on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. If you're brand new to the program, the story you are going to hear for the next 3 hours will scare the living daylights out of you. And, of course, if you've been a regular listener of Coast to Coast, you know what we're talking about. One of our favorite guests, David Politis, back with us, author of Missing 411 and several other works related to people disappearing primarily in our national parks, but disappearing. David, of course, has had a professional background that includes 20-plus years in law enforcement and senior executive positions in the technology sector. Here he is back on Coast to Coast. Oh, David, good time to have you back. Spring is here. People going out into the parks. Here we go again, right?
You got that right, George. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Indeed. Let's do a quick review, David, for some people who are brand new to the program and they come in by the thousands every month, to give them an idea of what we're talking about here, these missing people.
So about 6 years ago, I was doing some research on a national park, talking to some of the contract workers there. I saw a couple of national park rangers following me around, kind of normal. I went back to my room off the park area, got a knock on the door. It was one of those rangers, dressed in plain clothes. He said, "Dave, I know who you are. We were following you around. We wanted to talk to you about something." And I said, "Well, come on in." And he said that he and a couple of their friends have worked at a series of national parks over their career, and they had been involved in searches for missing people. And just by chance, they got together and talked about their experiences, and they agreed that where these people went missing, the length of time they were gone, the effort that was made to find them was wholesome and hard for during that first 7 to 10 days. Then after that, it just drops off the face of the earth and there's no more work done on it. And they said that even they had a difficult time finding some information about the cases that they had exchanged amongst themselves. And they said that somebody really ought to be looking into it because nobody at the Park Service was. Well, I left the park the following day, called a couple friends in law enforcement, told them what I found out, and said, "Hey, see if there's anything to this and see if there's disappearances there that haven't been solved." A few hours later, I get a call back, and they said, "Oh, yeah, there's quite a few disappearances from there. And there appears to be something unusual. That kind of started it all. Started the focus on the National Park Service. I filed a series of Freedom of Information Act requests. They have a very large contingent of federally trained law enforcement police officers that patrol the park area. They've all gone to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. They're highly trained. They are good police officers, and they know how to do the right job. I filed a request against the police department for the National Park Service for a list of missing people inside their system. I get a call back from an attorney from the National Park Service asking why I wanted the information. And I said, well, I was just interested in the numbers and doing a little research. And he said, well, National Park Service doesn't keep track of missing people like that. They don't have any numbers. They don't keep track. They don't have a list of names. And originally I thought maybe it was some kind of semantics, and so I worked with some other people, and we refiled, got a call back again, the same thing. We don't have a list. We never have had a list. And, George, any medium or small police department almost in the nation, you could walk into their police chief and say, hey, can you give me a list of missing people from your department? And within a matter of minutes, probably no more than an hour or two, he would give you a list.
He's probably got them up on his bulletin board behind his desk.
Exactly. And for sure, they're up on their website as well. But the National Park Service claims no knowledge of this. And when I pushed them a little further, they stated, and I'll quote this, we rely on the institutional memory of our employees for those things.
Jeez, that makes no sense, David.
No. And you could feel the roadblock that they were throwing, and I talked to a whole series of law enforcement people about it, and they said, Dave, there is no way they're not keeping this information. They've got to have it. Well, keep plodding along as the years go by and the research keeps getting thicker. You start to realize that there's also disappearances in national forests, very similar to what's happening in national parks. And what I laid out was a series of young children, say 2 to 6 years old, where they went missing from and where they were found. And many times these kids would be found miles away in a rural environment where there's no roads. And the trek, when you approach their parents with it, they'd say, oh, my two-year-old can't walk that far. Or they'd be found thousands of feet up in elevation from where they were last seen.
Alive or dead?
Dead.
Ugh.
And, you know, those kind of things strike you as highly unusual. And when the parents say, hey, there's no way my child could have gone that distance, and being a parent, you know how far your child can travel.
Of course.
Well, since we're talking about young kids right now, just today, news broke out of a place called Austin, Manitoba. Austin's 50 miles west of Manitoba, west of Winnipeg. It's a very, very rural area. A lot of farm country. A two-year-old boy named Chase Martens, M-A-R-T-E-N-S, was playing outside his farmhouse. His dad was on one side of the farmhouse. His mom was inside. He had a couple sisters that were also in the house. His mom sees the son run around the side of the house, and she thought he was going to go play on the tractor like he always does.
Okay.
They had a couple dogs in the yard, and she said the dogs always follow this boy around. Well, after 10 minutes, she didn't see him. She goes out to the yard. He's gone. The dad starts searching. The dogs just laid in the back porch the whole time. And make a long story short, that happened at 6 o'clock Tuesday night. All through the night last night, 200 searchers and canines searched that area. The Winnipeg helicopter from their police department came in and flew FLIR, forward-looking radar, all over the farm fields and forests around there. Nothing.
Ugh.
Today they put 300 ground searchers there, along with an RCMP airplane, and the Winnipeg helicopter came back. And as of right now, we're speaking, that boy can't be found.
What a nightmare for the parents, David. An absolute nightmare.
And when you go online, George, and you see, the searchers are doing the right thing. They're marching almost shoulder to shoulder through the fields out there. And that's what they're out there, fields. And then there's interspersed with trees and a little bit of ground cover, nothing serious. And especially the time of the year, a helicopter flying with FLIR right now should be able to light up that whole area and see if there's somebody there that's emitting heat. Now, in probably a very high percentage of these cases, one of the profile points I write about in my books is that oftentimes these victims are found in an area that had been searched sometimes 10, 20 times.
And they know that they have not missed the body, and then they come back, like you say, the 10th time, and there it is.
Exactly. And the searchers are befuddled. A few years back, I was making a presentation in front of the largest search and rescue organization in the world. And I was talking about this, just like I am with you right now, and kind of laying out the groundwork. And in Alaska, the state troopers, Alaska state troopers, take charge of all search and rescue in the state. And about halfway through my talk, there were some questions, and this trooper stood up and said, "Dave, you're saying what we all know, and we don't want to talk about, but we've all had it happen to us, and it's unexplainable. How this is happening, and how these people end up in an area that we've covered completely, and bam, they're right in the middle of it, makes no sense."
And they don't want to talk about it. Why? Are they afraid?
Well, I think that some organizations in the search and rescue business want to keep their faux pas, which they consider faux pas, to themselves. I personally don't think, and I've never said that this is a search and rescue issue, they're not doing a competent job, etc. I don't think that when they're searching, it's there.
And we've talked before, David, many times. We do not push you for an answer because you're not going to give us one anyways, but we do talk about possibilities, and I want everybody to know that tonight. We're not going to say we think it's this, but we're going to talk about possibilities, and then you can decide what you think. But I've got to tell you, it is as bizarre as anything I've ever heard, and it's got to be for you too, David.
Well, what's tough, George, and you're a parent, you know this, that when you see these stories come across, like this one with Chase that I just talked to you about, it tugs at everybody's heart who's a parent.
Oh, it does. Yeah.
You know, I can't say that I can feel for the parents and know what they're going through, but I can tell you that it's got to be one of the most horrific things a human can go through, not knowing what's happened to their child.
You know, I used to, when I was younger, with my children, I would see people at a mall or shopping center with a dog leash on their kid, and it was attached to his back, you know, with some kind of an apparatus. And I used to think, David, that was the cruelest thing I could ever see, until it dawned on me, they're petrified of the kid wandering away. And, you know, they want to give him about 20 feet, and, you know, they kind of like tug him back when he gets too far. I don't think it's that bad anymore.
You know, I think that there's going to be those people who thought like you did. But once you read the cases, how a parent says, "My son, my little two-year-old, was right behind me. He can't run that fast. I turned around and he's gone."
Just gone.
Exactly.
Just gone.
It makes you think, well, maybe those devices might be pretty good.
In terms of the sex of the missing person, is it more male than female, or is it the same? Does it balance out?
I think as you get older and you start talking about men or adult women, on that end of the scale, it's more men. I think at the younger end of the scale, say between 2 and 8, it's almost a balancing point there.
Balancing, okay.
There's been a lot of young girls and a lot of young boys that have disappeared and been found under unusual circumstances.
And in terms of those people out in the parks when they get a little older, would it skew more men than women, or is it about 50-50? People who are just out there, they have a good time.
I think there's more men. Not by a huge percentage, but I do think there are more men. And a lot of times when the men disappear in those park settings, many, many times they're never found.
David has some amazing cases, and we've got some new ones we're going to talk about as well. And, of course, the one you just mentioned, how sad it is for those parents up there in Canada to be searching for their little one who simply just disappeared. And I wonder, David, how far away was their house from the road to rule out the possibility of some passerby coming by and picking the kid up?
You know, they talked about it briefly in one article, and it said that there was a dirt road that came up to the house. But coming from law enforcement, and you've got to apply logic to this, is that a pedophile or somebody who's trying to prey on a young person like this, one of the last things they want to do is be seen. And if you're going up to an isolated farmhouse somewhere in the middle of nowhere, you know, number one, those people carry guns.
That's right. And the mother and the father are going to hear a vehicle that comes up that kind of road. David, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about missing 411. And our special guest tonight for 3 hours of the program, David Politis, as we talk about missing 411, people who simply vanish. An incredible story. And we'll take your calls later on tonight with David as well, so you'll become part of the program. And welcome back to Coast, David Politis with us. David, on one of my computers in the studio, I've got my wallpaper on the computer is looks like a national park. I'm going to get rid of it right after this show. Get that away. So how are you doing on your Kickstarter campaign in the movie? Did you wrap that up, or are you still doing it?
You know, we are done with the Kickstarter long ago, many months ago.
Good.
We went 50% over our goal. We totally blew the numbers out.
Super.
Right now the movie is done with the first stage of editing. It's going to colorization and sound within the next 2 weeks. So we're right on target. Everything's going real good.
Good.
Appreciate the help you gave us.
And you're happy with it?
Oh, I'm ecstatic with it.
Okay, I can't wait to see it. And if you get us a little clip, we'll put it up on the website when the time comes, okay?
Absolutely.
Now, back to these. I'm going to ask you a mathematical question. And this would be, out of 10 people who disappear, what percent do you think are people who merely wander off and get lost? Whether they die or they're found later, not the case. But what percent of 10 do you think simply wander off?
I think it's a very high percentage. And when we go through the vetting process to get to the cases that we'll talk about, we take away all of the ambiguous nature associated with that. There's a lot of people who voluntarily want to disappear. Maybe they have mental health issues, they're suicidal, whatever. If there's anything about that in their profile, in their background, we won't look at that. There's an entire series of things that we look at that kind of narrow it down to what we're really focusing on. One of the big things is geographical clustering. There's 58 geographical clusters of these missing people that fit this profile in North America. One of them happens to just be very near Winnipeg,
mm-hmm.
where we talked about earlier. So in these geographical clusters, they go back not decades, sometimes centuries, with these same type of disappearances. We have one case going back to 1752 that's almost an exact hit to what we're talking about.
Jeez.
So I hear what you're saying. To give you a number, I'm sure it's extremely high because there aren't a large percentage of standard missing person cases that fit our profile.
Now, a serial killer wandering around the park system, I would say that might be pretty low.
I think we've talked about this on the air. I think it's infinitesimally small. The reason being is that I think it's been 5 years now. The law says that if you have a concealed weapons license, you can carry a gun in a park. Well, I live in Colorado, and I know on the trails in Colorado, probably 80 to 90% of the people on the trail carry guns. So if there's a serial killer out there, very soon there's just going to be a shootout on the trail.
No question.
Yep. Somebody's going to die. And you never hear about these type of abductions on the trail, killings, shootings. It just doesn't happen.
The next I'm going to cluster in a grouping of the unusual, the supernatural, and it could be Bigfoot is grabbing somebody, a UFO is beaming people up, perhaps a portal, some kind of other dimension that they fall into and they can't find their way back. I'm going to cluster all those together, David. And, you know, based on just reading your books and the work you've done, I would say that's a probability that cannot be ruled out.
So in this first hour, we were going to talk about just cases in national parks, forests, and things. And then in that second hour, we were going to talk about my last book, and that is Disappearances of Young Men in near rivers, creeks, ponds, etc., mm-hmm. where they just disappeared, sometimes amongst a group of many people. Nobody saw them leave. They just vanish, and they're found later on in this body of water. Well, to me, I mean, there's a lot of people out there who say, oh, it's got to be Bigfoot, or it's got to be this, or it's got to be that. I have yet, and I'm not just saying this, but there's thousands of friends on Facebook that comment daily about this.
Yes.
I personally do not know, George, of anyone who has read all of the books and has said, yep, it's got to be this. Because once they read the books, the variables don't fit any one specific entity or idea. And many people think that there could be something unilateral going on. You know Richard Dolan.
Oh, real well.
So Richard and I talk. We have these really great conversations because he's a super smart guy.
Oh, he really is. He's a human think tank, isn't he?
Oh, he is. And he said, you know, Dave, after reading the books, he goes, I think sometimes that it's got to be some overreaching intelligence that is so far beyond our comprehension in how it works, how it targets, how it deciphers when and where to do it, that we couldn't even understand it probably if they explained it.
Well, you know what? You can't rule that out.
Right.
You cannot rule it out. It is so baffling, so frustrating. I tell you what, I would be hesitant to take a group of people or kids into a national park system without watching them every second. And you know you can't do that.
No, you can't.
It's impossible.
You know, you were talking about the movie. I was in Larimer County, Colorado, and we were talking to the undersheriff about a case that's in the movie. And one of the questions I always ask one of these administrators in any sheriff's department is, I said, hey, do you have any open cases out there that fit with what we're talking about? And this undersheriff in Larimer County said, yeah, I sure do. Well, in past shows and in my past books, I've talked about there seems to be an abnormal number of people that have a German heritage. And I almost fell out of my chair when the sheriff came back and handed me the report on this guy who went missing in Rocky Mountain National Park in February of 1983. He was 27 years old. His name was Rudy Motor.
That sounds German.
Rudy was a German national on vacation. He had prior time with the German Mountain Army Corps.
Oh, my
gosh.
He
was a veteran of two different Himalayan trips, and he was considered an expert in mountaineering and extreme weather conditions. Well, he came out to see a friend that lived outside of Denver, and he was traveling with him, and he said, hey, just give me a couple, 3 days, and I want to go into the backcountry of the park, and I just want to see what it's like here. He took all of his equipment. His friend dropped him off. He had some cross-country skis. And he goes, I'll meet you here in 3 days.
And he's well-trained. I mean, really well-trained, right?
I don't think he'd get much better, George. You know, this guy was elite of the elite and in prime physical shape. So he didn't make it back. His friend called the sheriff. The sheriff came out and searched. And it was a four-day search, 40 searchers. They did find a small cave that they know that he dug because there was a food cache in it that he had put there. So they do overflights. There were two helicopters committed by the Park Service. They don't find anything. But what's more perplexing to this is that we're looking at 30-plus years now. They've never found him, which, okay, maybe you don't find him.
Maybe you don't find him, yeah.
But where's the skis? Where's the bindings? Where's his belt? Where's his boots that he was wearing? He's never found.
Yeah, that's weird. That is weird. And you know, and you can't just simply think, all right, somebody killed him and took his skis. I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Not where this guy was. He was in an area called Thunder Pass.
There's probably nobody else there.
Exactly. No, you and I wouldn't even think about going there.
No.
And an avalanche, they came back the following year, they searched, they never found him. And so there wasn't any avalanche activity in the area when they searched. There was nothing. It's like, you know, whoosh, he's gone.
What is the tie-in with being German? That's weird.
That is very strange. And in my last book, Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence, that dealt with young men who disappeared, there were a lot of these with this German heritage from the Wisconsin area that vanished under these highly unusual circumstances. So I really don't know what to think of it, other than when you put the faces of these boys, young men, up next to each other, they all kind of look the same. It's weird.
What percent of those that disappear are then found dead later? Physically found?
Oh, I would say that's probably, of the ones I've written about, 70% maybe.
Are any of them mauled or torn apart like an animal would have gotten them?
An extremely, extremely small percent, probably less than 3%.
Wow.
And in those cases, in fact, there's one case out of the Yukon Territory I can think of where they thought that a bear might have attacked him. Well, it's strange because in reports written in articles and newspapers and things, it says that there's bear scat found at the scene with his clothing in the scat. Well, I interviewed the natural resource officer on that case. His name was Bart Schleyer, the stud of all studs, a mountain man, a graduate of Montana State, and an expert on bear. And the natural resource officer who investigated that case for Yukon said, Dave, it was an absolute lie. There was no clothing. I don't know where they got that. I don't know who said it. But it didn't come from me, and I was the guy in charge of the investigation.
If anybody dies out in the wilderness, will an animal eat a dead body or not?
Oh, yeah.
They would.
Oh, yeah.
See, so that's weird, too. You know, if they're out there in the wilderness, they're dead, they're a food source for something, and they're not eaten. That's strange.
Well, if you think about that, the point I made earlier about found in a place that was previously searched. So there's one case in particular where they took the same trail out to find this boy for a week. They don't find him. The eighth day, they're going, hundreds of people go out the same trail. And on the eighth day, they're getting up, they leave, and there's a tree that's been knocked down or fell down is laying across the trail. And George, the boy's body is laying on top of the tree.
No way. Oh.
Now, I don't care who you are. You've got to think, there's a message there somewhere.
That's right.
They for sure want us to find that body. But then my question is, where was this boy during the previous times? And in search and rescue, the coroners and the medical examiners are never thinking like you and I. The search and rescue professionals are thinking, hey, we found the body, great, our job's done.
Yeah.
Now, in my last book, where the people were found in water, water's a different environment in that you can gauge, based on the temperature of the water, how long somebody's there based on the degradation of the body. Well, some super smart medical examiners on a few of these cases were really paying attention, and they realized, the guy's been missing for 2 weeks. He only shows indications of being in the water for 3 days. Where's he been for the last 7 to 10 days?
Exactly.
And a lot of medical examiners don't want to rock the boat. And there's two of them that I talk to regularly about this. They know something really strange is going on. They know that it's not normal for them not to find a cause of death. And in the cases I write about, a high percentage of time, the coroners can't find a cause of death.
That's strange, too. Does anybody hear, those that have been with people who disappear, does anybody hear screams or shouting or anything like that?
It's not the norm by a very high percentage. Most of the time, it's nothing. It's like the dad will say, well, the child was right by me, and I turned around, and he was gone. There was a case in Tennessee a few months ago where a grandma took a little boy for a walk, and she said, well, yeah, he was right here with us, and I turned my back, and he was gone. And you hear this time after time, and you think, how could it, especially a really small child, get such a far distance that they won't hear you, you can't see them, and then they bring the dogs in, the canines in, and they can't track them? That's not normal.
Are the parents generally the chief suspect with police when something like this happens, David?
I think at the beginning, it's whoever is with that child last. They have to take that hard look.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them. If I was the parent, I'd say, hey, take me right now, put me on the polygraph so you can exclude me and get on with your work.
Yep.
But no, you're right. They do take that hard look. And in the cases I've talked about with you over the years, every time the parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, whoever, they're not suspects.
And, you know, we talked about the case here in Canada, and, of course, a lot in the United States we'll get into. Is this happening worldwide, or is it just restricted to North America?
No, it's a worldwide issue, and the cases are so cookie-cutter that when you read about them in the books, some of the comments I've had, it said, it's almost like reading repetition, and after a while it gets boring because there's the factors involved are so identical. But if I don't lay it out and you don't see for yourself that this is the exact way it is, it's easy to discount it and say, ah, it's not really the way he says it is. But when I lay out police report language of what the police say and how the canine handlers say their dogs reacted and how the overflights with the FLIR and the plane see nothing, how can that be?
Yeah. And now, the dogs, do they not pick up the scent, or they just don't want to follow it?
It's all the above. I've had in reports say that the dog walked in a circle, laid down in front of my feet, and either had no interest or didn't want to go down the trail, or there was no scent. But they know that the victim had to have gone that direction in their mind because of the statements from the people that were there.
The disappearances are primarily in these park systems, or could it happen in suburban neighborhood?
Well, I think that this example out of Winnipeg is perfect. I mean, it can happen in almost any rural area, and that's the way I started with this. As it's evolved, if you stay with those profile points and you apply it to a broader spectrum, as some people have recommended I did years ago, you start to see, son of a gun, you can walk slowly into an urban area, and then under some circumstances, this applies. And I've written about them a few times. Not normal. There aren't a lot, but there's a few. There's a couple cases out of the Carolinas where a boy went to sleep in a house with his aunt and their dog.
In the house?
In the house. The alarm was on in the house. 20 minutes later, the aunt's phone rings, and it's her husband saying, hey, how's it going? How's our nephew? Whatever. And she looks, and the dog's gone, and the boy's gone. And the alarm didn't go off.
The alarm didn't go off. It should have.
And just so happens that there was a second boy that disappeared within miles of that location a few years before that, disappeared, also wasn't found. Two boys in the same proximity, very similar circumstances, were never found.
Very, very strange indeed. David, give us your website.
It's, first of all, don't go to Amazon and buy the books. Those are resellers charging exorbitant prices.
Aha.
We sell them on our website. It's Can-Am, like Canadian American, canammissing.com.
Super. We're with David Politis. We're talking about his Missing 411 series. I've got to tell you, folks, one of the most riveting stories I have ever heard in my career as a broadcaster since 1969. That's a long, long time. We're going to come back later on with David Politis, of course, and take your calls. But next hour, we're going to get into some more specific cases, new cases of disappearance. And it's just chilling, absolutely chilling. So stick with us. And David's going to have a movie out soon, and we'll let you know all about that as well. And if the movie's anywhere as close to the book, and I'm sure it will be, it'll chill you, but you gotta watch it. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.